Everything else follows from that. It's confidence, optimism, the one thing that other countries find so strange about us. If you take that away, hell, we're no different from anybody else. The short answer to your question, Mr. President, is that the economic problem is far more dangerous to us than what the Japs just did. You surprise me, Durling said. Sir, like Buzz said, would you prefer a lie? What the hell is the problem? Ron Jones asked. The sun was already up, and USS Pasadena was visible, still tied to her pier, the national ensign hanging forlornly in the still air. A fighting ship of the United States Navy was doing nothing at all, and the son of his mentor was dead at the hands of an enemy. Why wasn't anyone doing something about it? She doesn't have orders, Mancuso said, because I don't have orders, because SyncPAC doesn't have orders, because National Command Authority hasn't issued any orders.
They awake there?
SecDef's supposed to be in the White House now. The President's been briefed in by now, probably, ComSubPAC thought.
But he can't get his thumb out, Jones observed.
He is the President, Ron. We do what he says.
Yeah, like Johnson sent my dad to Vietnam.
Jones turned to look at the wall chart. By the end of the day, the Japanese surface ships would be out of range for the carriers, which couldn't launch strikes anyway. USS Gary had concluded her search for survivors, mainly out of fear of lingering Japanese submarines out there, but for all the world looking as though she'd been chased off the site by a Coast Guard cutter. The intelligence they did have was based on satellite information because it hadn't been thought prudent even to send a P-3C out to shadow the surface force, much less prosecute the submarine contacts.
First out of harm's way, eh?
Mancuso decided not to get angry this time. He was a flag officer and paid to think like one.
One thing at a time. Our most important assets at risk are those two carriers. We have to get them in and we have to get them fixed. Wally is planning operations right now. We have to gather intelligence, think it over, and then decide what we can do.
And then see if he'll let us. Mancuso nodded. That's how the system works.
Great.
The dawn was pleasing indeed. Sitting on the upper deck of the 747, Yamada had taken a window seat on the port side, looking out the window and ignoring the buzz of conversation around him. He had scarcely slept in 3 days, and still the rush of power and elation filled him like a flood. This was the last pre-scheduled flight in. Mainly administrative personnel, along with some engineers and civilians, who would start to put the new government in place. The bureaucrats with that task had been fairly clever in their way. Of course, everyone on Saipan would have a vote, and the elections would be subject to international scrutiny, a political necessity. There were about 29,000 local citizens, but that didn't count Japanese, many of whom now owned land, homes, and business enterprises. Nor did it count soldiers and others staying in hotels. The hotels, the largest were Japanese-owned, of course, would be considered condominiums, and all those in the condo units residents. As Japanese citizens, they each had a vote. The soldiers were citizens as well, and also had the franchise, and since their garrison status was indeterminate, they were also considered residents. Between the soldiers and the civilians, there were 31,000 Japanese on the island, and when elections were held, well, his countrymen were assiduous in making use of their civil rights, weren't they? International scrutiny, he thought, staring out to the east. Be damned. It was especially pleasing to watch from 37,000 feet the first muted glow on the horizon, which seemed much like a garnish for a bouquet of still visible stars. The glow brightened and expanded from purple to deep red to pink to orange, and then the first sliver of the face of the sun, not yet visible on the black sea below, and it was though the sunrise were for him alone, Yamada thought, long before the lower people got to enjoy and savor it. The aircraft turned slightly to the right, beginning its descent.
The downward path through the early morning air was perfectly timed, seeming to hold the sun in place all the way down, just the yellow, white, silver, preserving the magical moment for several minutes. The sheer glory moved Yamata nearly to tears. He still remembered the faces of his parents, their modest home on Saipan. His father had been a minor and not terribly prosperous merchant, mainly selling trinkets and notions to the soldiers who garrisoned the island. His father had always been very polite to them, Ryuzo remembered, smiling, bowing, accepting their rough jokes about his polio-shriveled leg. The boy who had watched thought it normal to be deferential to men carrying arms, wearing his nation's uniform. He'd learned different since, of course. They were merely servants. Whether they carried on the samurai tradition or not, the very word samurai was a derivation of the verb to serve, he reminded himself, clearly implying a master, no? It was they who looked after and protected their betters, and it was their betters who hired them and paid them and told them what to do. It was necessary to treat them with greater respect than they really deserved, but the odd thing was that the higher they went in rank, the better they understood what their place really was. "We will touch down in 5 minutes," a colonel told him. "Dozo." A nod rather than a bow, because he was sitting down. But even so, the nod was a measured one, precisely of the sort to acknowledge the service of an underling, showing him both politeness and superiority in the same pleasant gesture. In time, if this colonel was a good one and gained general's rank, then the nod would change, and if he proceeded further, then some day, if he were lucky, Yamada-san might call his given name in friendship, single him out for a smile and a joke, invite him for a drink, and in his advancement to high command learn who the master really was. The colonel probably looked forward to achieving that goal. Yamada buckled his seatbelt and smoothed his hair. Captain Sato was exhausted. He'd just spent far too much time in the air, not merely breaking, but shredding the crew rest rules of his airline. But he, too, could not turn away from his duty. He looked off to the left and saw in the morning sky the blinking strokes of two fighters, probably F-15s, one of them perhaps flown by his son, circling to protect the soil of what was once again their country. Gently, he told himself. There were soldiers of his country under his care, and they deserved the best. One hand on the throttles, the other on the wheel, he guided the Boeing airliner down an invisible line in the air toward a point his eyes had already selected. On his command to the co-pilot, the huge flaps went down all the way. Sato eased back on the yoke, bringing up the nose and flaring the aircraft, letting it settle, floating it in, until only the screech of rubber told them that they were on the ground. "You are a poet," the co-pilot said, once more impressed by the man's skill. Sato allowed himself a smile as he engaged reverse thrust. "You taxi in." Then he keyed the cabin intercom. "Welcome to Japan," he told the passengers. Yamata didn't shout, only because the remark surprised him so. He didn't wait for the aircraft to stop before he unbuckled. The door to the flight deck was right there, and he had to say something.
"Captain?"
"Yes, Yamata-san."
"You understand, don't you?"
His nod was that of a proud professional, and in that moment one very much akin to the Zaibatsu.
"Hai."
His reward was a bow of the finest sincerity, and it warmed the pilot's heart to see Yamata-san's respect. The businessman was not in a hurry, not now. The bureaucrats and administrative soldiers worked their way off the aircraft into waiting buses that would take them to the Hotel Nikko Saipan, a large, modern establishment located in the center of the island's west coast, which would be the temporary administrative headquarters for the new government, Yamata corrected himself. It took 5 minutes for all of them to deplane, after which he made his own way off to another Toyota Land Cruiser, whose driver this time was one of his employees who knew what to do without being told, and knew that this was a moment for Yamata to savor in silence. He scarcely noticed the activity. Though he'd caused it to happen, it was less important than its anticipation had been. Oh, perhaps a brief smile at the sight of the military vehicles. But the fatigue was real now, and his eyes drooped despite an iron will that commanded them to be bright and wide. The driver had planned the route with care and managed to avoid the major tie-ups. Soon they passed the Marianas Country Club again, and though the sun was up, there were no golfers in evidence. There was no military presence either, except for two satellite uplink trucks on the edge of the parking lot, newly painted green after having been appropriated from NHK. No, we mustn't harm the golf course, now, without a doubt, the most expensive single piece of real estate on the island. It was right about here, Yamata thought, remembering the shape of the hills. His father's rude little store had been close to the North Airfield, and he could remember the A-6M Type Zero fighters, the strutting aviators, and the often overbearing soldiers. Over there had been the sugarcane processing plant of Nanyokohatsu Kaisha, and he could remember stealing small bits of the cane and chewing on them. And how fair the breezy mornings had been. Soon they were on his land. Yamata shook off the cobwebs by force of will and stepped out of the car, walking north now. It was the way his father and mother and brother and sister must have come, and he imagined he could see his father, hobbling on his crippled leg, struggling for the dignity that his childhood disease had always denied him. Had he served the soldiers in those last days, bringing them what useful things he had? Had the soldiers in those last days set aside their crude insults at his physical condition and thanked him with the sincerity of men for whom death was now something seen and felt in its approach? Yamata chose to believe both, and they would have come down this draw, their retreat toward death protected by the last rearguard action of soldiers in their last moment of perfection. It was called Banzai Cliff by the locals, Suicide Cliff by the less racist. Yamata would have to have his public relations people work on changing the name to something more respectful. July 9, 1944, the day organized resistance ended, the day the Americans had declared the island of Saipan secure. There were actually two cliffs, curved and facing inward as though a theater. The taller of them was 240 meters above the surface of the beckoning sea. There were marble columns to mark the spot, built years earlier by Japanese students, shaped to represent children kneeling in prayer. It would have been here that they'd approached the edge, holding hands. He could remember his father's strong hands. Would his brother and sister have been afraid? Probably more disoriented than fearful, he thought, after 21 days of noise and horror and incomprehension. Mother would have looked at father, a warm, short, round woman whose jolly musical laugh rang again in her son's ears. The soldiers had occasionally been gruff with his father, but never with her, and never with the children. And the last service the soldiers had rendered had been to keep the Americans away from them at that final moment, when they'd stepped off the cliff. Holding hands, Yamata chose to believe, each holding a child in a final loving embrace, proudly refusing to accept captivity at the hands of barbarians and orphaning their other son. Yamata could close his eyes and see it all, and for the first time the memory and the imagined sight made his body shudder with emotion. He'd never allowed himself anything more than rage before, all the times he'd come here over the years. But now he could truly let the emotions out and weep with pride, for he had repaid his debt of honor to those who had given him birth, and his debt of honor to those who had done them to death, in full. The driver watched, not knowing, but understanding. For he knew the history of this place, and he too was moved to tears as a shaking man of 60-odd years clapped his hands to call the attention of sleeping relatives. From 100 meters away he saw the man's shoulders rack with sobs, and after a time Yamata lay down on his side in his business suit and went to sleep. Perhaps he would dream of them. Perhaps the spirits of whoever it was, the driver thought, would visit him in his sleep, and say what things he needed to hear. But the real surprise, the driver thought, was that the old bastard had a soul at all. Perhaps he'd misjudged his boss. "Damn if they ain't organized," Areza said to himself, looking through his binoculars, the cheap ones he kept in the house. The living room window afforded a view of the airports, and the kitchen gave one of the harbor. Orchid Ace was long gone, and another car ferry had taken her berth. Century Highway Number 5, her name was, and this one was unloading jeep-type vehicles and trucks. Portugee was fairly strung out, having forced himself to stay up all night. He'd now done 27 hours without sleep, and some of them spent working hard on the ocean west of the island. He was too old for that sort of thing, the Master Chief knew. Burroughs, younger and smarter, had curled up on the living room rug and was snoring away. Areza wished for a cigarette for the first time in years. They were good for staying alert. You just needed them at a time like this. They were what a warrior used. At least that's what the World War II movies proclaimed. But this wasn't World War II, and he wasn't a warrior. For all he'd done in his over 30 years in the United States Coast Guard, he'd never fired a shot in anger, even on his one Vietnam tour. Someone else had always been on the gun. He didn't know how to fight. "Up all night?" Isabel asked, dressed for her job. It was Monday on this side of the international dateline and a work day. She looked down and saw that the pad of notepaper usually kept next to the phone was covered with scribbles and numbers. "Does it matter?" "I don't know, Is. Want some breakfast?" "It can't hurt," Pete Burrows said, stretching as he came into the kitchen. "I think I conked out around 3. A moment's consideration. I feel like hell," he said in deference to the lady in the room. "Well, I have to be at my desk in an hour or so," Mrs. Areza observed, pulling open the refrigerator. Breakfast in this house consisted of a selection of cold cereals and skim milk, Burroughs saw, along with toast made of the bread baked from straw. Toss in a little fruit, he thought, and he could have been back in San Jose. The coffee he could already smell. He found a cup and poured some. "Somebody really knows how to do this right." "It's Manny," Isabel said. Areza smiled for the first time in hours. "I learned it from my first chief. The right blend, the right proportions, and a pinch of salt. Probably in the dark of the moon and after sacrificing a goat," Burroughs thought. If so, however, the goat had died for a noble cause. He took a long sip and came over to check Areza's tally sheet. "That many? Could be conservative. It's 2 flying hours from here to Japan. That's 4 on the round trip. Let's be generous and say 90 minutes on the ground at each end. 7-hour cycle. 3.5 trips per airplane per day. Each flight about 300, maybe 350 soldiers per hop. That means every plane brings in 1,000 men, 15 airplanes operating over 1 day. That means a whole division of troops. You suppose the Japs have more than 15 747s? Portugee asked. Like I said, conservative. Now it's just a matter of bringing their mobile equipment in. How many ships for that? Another frown. Not sure. During the Persian Gulf War, I was over there, then doing port security work. Damn, depends on what ships you use and how you pack 'em. I'll be conservative again. 20 large merchant hulls just to ferry in the gear, trucks, jeeps, all kinds of stuff you'd never think of. It's like moving a city full of people. They need to resupply fuel. This rock doesn't grow enough food, and that has to come in by ship, too, and the population of this place just doubled. The water supply might be stretched. Areza looked down and made a notation on that. Anyway, they came to stay, that's for damn sure, he said, heading for the table and his special K, wishing for 3 eggs up, bacon, white bread toast with butter, hash browns, and all the cholesterol that went with it. Damn, turning 50. What about me? The engineer asked. I seen you pass for a local. I sure as hell can't. Pete, you're my charter, and I'm the captain, okay? I'm responsible for your safety. That's the law of the sea, sir. We're not at sea anymore, Burroughs pointed out. Areza was annoyed by the truth of the observation. My daughter's a lawyer. I try to keep things simple. Eat your breakfast. I need some sleep, and you have to take over the forenoon watch. What about me? Mrs. Areza asked. If you don't show up for work, somebody will wonder why. It'll be nice to know if they told the truth about the cops who got shot, her husband went on. I've been up all night, Iz. I haven't heard a single shot. Every crossroad seems to be manned, but they're not doing anything to anybody. He paused. I don't like it either, honey. One way or another, we have to deal with it.
Did you do it, Ed? Derling asked bluntly, his eyes boring in on his vice president. He cursed the man for forcing him to deal with one more problem among the multiple crises hanging over his presidency now, but the post-peace gave him no choice.
Why are you hanging me out to dry? Why didn't you at least warn me of this?
The president waved around the Oval Office. There are a lot of things you can do in here, and there are things you can't do. One of them is to interfere with a criminal investigation.
Don't give me that. A lot of people have...
Yeah, and they all paid a price for it, too. It's not my ass that needs to be covered, Roger Derling didn't say. I'm not risking mine for yours. You didn't answer my question.
Look, Roger, Ed Keelty snarled back. The president stopped him with a raised hand and a quiet voice.
Ed, I have an economy in meltdown. I have dead sailors in the Pacific Ocean. I can't spare the energy for this. I can't spare the political capital. I can't spare the time. Answer my question, Derling commanded. The vice president flushed, his head snapping to the right before he spoke.
All right, I like women. I've never hidden that from anyone. My wife and I have an understanding.
His head came back.
But I have never, never molested, assaulted, raped, or forced myself on anybody in my whole fucking life. Never. I don't have to.
Lisa Berenger, Derling said, consulting his notes for the name.
She was a sweet thing, very bright, very sincere, and she begged me to... Well, you can guess...
I explained to her that I couldn't. I was up for re-election that year, and besides, she was too young. She deserved somebody her age to marry and give her kids and a good life. She took it hard, started drinking. Maybe something else, but I don't think so. Anyway, one night she headed off on the Beltway and lost it, Roger. I was there for the funeral. I still talk with her parents.
Well, Keelty said. Not lately, I guess.
She left a note, a letter behind. More than one. Keelty reached into his coat pocket and handed two envelopes over. I'm surprised nobody noticed the date on the one the FBI has. 10 days before her death. This one's a week later, and this one is the day she was killed. My staff found them. I suppose Barbara Linders found the other one. None were ever mailed. I think you'll find some differences between them. All three, as a matter of fact.
The Linders girl says that you drugged her?
Keelty shook his head. You know about my drinking problem. You knew it when you asked me in. Yeah, I'm an alcoholic, but I had my last drink 2 years ago.
A crooked smile.
My sex life is even better now.
Back to Barbara. She was sick that day, the flu. She went to the pharmacy on the hill and got a prescription. And
how do you know that?
Maybe I keep a diary. Maybe I just have a good memory. Either way, I know the date this happened. Maybe one of my staffers checked the records of the pharmacy, and maybe the medication she took had a label on the bottle, one that says don't drink while using these capsules. I didn't know that, Roger. When I have a cold, well, back then anyway, I used brandy.
Hell, Keelty admitted, I used booze for a lot of things.
So I gave some to her, and she became very cooperative.
A little too cooperative, I suppose, but I was having the bag myself, and I figured it was just my well-known charm.
So... What are you telling me? You're not guilty.
You want to say I'm an alley cat? Can't keep it zipped? Yeah, I guess so. I've been to priests, to doctors, to a clinic once. Covering that up was some task. Finally, I went to the head of neuroscience at Harvard Medical School. They think there's a part of the brain that regulates our drives, just a theory, but a good one. It goes along with hyperactivity. I was a hyperactive child. I still don't ever sleep more than 6 hours a night, Roger. I am all those things, but I am not a rapist.
So, there it was, Derling thought. Not a lawyer himself. He had appointed, consulted, and heard enough of them to know what he'd been told. Keelty could defend himself on two grounds. that the evidence against him was more equivocal than the investigators imagined, and that it wasn't really his fault. The president wondered which of the defenses might be true. Neither, one, both. "So, what are you going to do?" he asked the vice president, using much the same voice he'd summoned a few hours earlier for the ambassador from Japan. He was increasingly sympathetic with the man sitting across from him, in spite of himself. What if the guy really was telling the truth? How could he know? And that was what the jury would say, after all, if it got that far. And if a jury would think that, then what would the judiciary hearings be like? Keelty still had a lot of markers out on the hill. "Somehow I just don't think anyone's going to print up Derling Keelty bumper stickers this summer, right?" The question came with a smile of sorts. "Not if I have anything to say about it," the president confirmed, cold again. This wasn't a time for humor. "I don't want to hurt you, Roger. I did 2 days ago. If you'd warned me, I could have told you these things sooner, saved everybody a lot of time and trouble, including Barbara. I lost track of her. She's very good on civil rights stuff, a good head on her, and a good heart. It was only that one time, you know, and she stayed in my office afterwards," Keelty pointed out. "We've covered that, Ed. Tell me what you want." "I'll go. I'll resign. I don't get prosecuted." "Not good enough," Derling said in a neutral voice. "Oh, I'll admit my weaknesses. I'll apologize to you, honorable public servant that you are, for any harm I might have done to your presidency. My lawyers will meet with their lawyers, and we'll negotiate compensation. I leave public life." "And if that's not good enough?" "It will be," Keelty said confidently. "I can't be tried in a court until the constitutional issues are resolved. Months, Roger. All the way to summer, probably. Maybe all the way to the convention. You can't afford that. I figure the worst-case scenario for you is the Judiciary Committee sends the bill of impeachment to the floor of the House, but the House doesn't pass it, or maybe does, narrowly. And then the Senate trial ends up with a hung jury, so to speak. Do you have any idea how many favors I've done there and in the Senate?" Keelty shook his head. "It's not worth the political risk to you, and it distracts you and the Congress from the business of government. You need all the time you have. Hell, you need more than that." Keelty stood and headed toward the door to the president's right, the one that was so perfectly blended into the curved eggshell white walls and gold trim. He spoke his final words without turning. "Anyway, it's up to you now." It angered President Roger Derling that in the end the easy way out might be the just way out as well, but nobody would ever know. They would only know that his final action was politically expedient in a moment of history that demanded political expediency. An economy potentially in ruins, a war just started. He didn't have the time to fool with this. A young woman had died. Others claimed to have been molested, but what if the dead young girl had died for other reasons? What if the others... God damn it, he swore in his mind. That was something for a jury to decide. But it had to pass through three separate legal procedures before a jury could decide, and then any defense lawyer with half a brain could say that a fair trial was impossible anyway, after C-SPAN had done its level best to tell the whole world every bit of evidence, tainting everything and denying Keelty his constitutional right to a fair and impartial trial before disinterested jurors. That ruling was likely enough in a federal district court trial, and even more so on appeal, and would gain the victims nothing. And what if the bastard actually was, technically speaking, innocent of a crime? An open zipper, distasteful though it was, did not constitute a crime. And neither he nor the country needed the distraction. Roger Derling buzzed his secretary. "Yes, Mr. President. Get me the Attorney General." He'd been wrong, Derling thought. Sure, he could interfere with a criminal investigation. He had to. And it was easy. Damn. Chapter 26. Catch-up. "He really said that?" Ed Foley leaned forward. It was easier for Mary Pat to grasp it than for her husband. "Sure enough. And it's all on his honor as a spy," Jack confirmed, quoting the Russian's words.
I always did like his sense of humor, the DDO said, getting her first laugh of the day and probably the last. He's studied us so hard that he's more American than Russian.
Oh, Jack thought. That's it. That explained Ed. The opposite was true of him. A Soviet specialist for nearly all of his career, he was more Russian than American. The realization occasioned his own smile.
Thoughts? The National Security Advisor asked.
Jack, it gives them the idea of the only three human assets we have on the ground over there. Bad Joss, man, Edward Foley said.
That's a consideration, Mary Patricia Foley agreed. But there's another consideration. Those three assets are cut off. Unless we can communicate with them, they might as well not be there.
Jack, how serious is this situation?
We are, for all practical purposes, at war, M.P. Jack had already relayed the gist of the meeting with the ambassador, including his parting comment.
She nodded. Okay, they're giving a war. Are we going to come?
I don't know, Ryan admitted. We have dead people out there. We have U.S. territory with another flag flying over it right now. But our ability to respond effectively is severely compromised, and we have this little problem at home. Tomorrow the markets and the banking system are going to have to come to terms with some very unpleasant realities.
Interesting coincidence, Ed noted. He was too old a hand in the intelligence business to believe in coincidences.
What's going to happen with that stuff, Jack? You know a lot about it.
I don't have a clue, guys. It's going to be bad. But how bad and how it's going to be bad, nobody's been here before. I suppose the good news is that things can't fall further. The bad news is the mentality that goes with the situation will be like a person trapped in a burning building. You may be safe where you are, but you can't get out either.
What agencies are looking into things? Ed Foley asked.
Just about all of them. The Bureau's the lead agency. It has the most available investigators. The SEC is better suited to it, but they don't have the troops for something this big.
Jack, in a period of less than 24 hours, somebody leaked the news on the vice president. He was in the Oval Office right now, they all knew. The market went in the crapper, and we had the attack on Pacific Fleet. And you just told us the most harmful thing to us is this economic thing.
If I were you, sir, I see your point, Ryan said, cutting Ed off a moment too soon for a complete picture.
He made a few notes, wondering how the hell he'd be able to prove anything as complex as the market situation was.
Is anybody that smart?
Lots of smart people in the world, Jack. Not all of them like us.
It was very much like talking with Sergei Nikolaevich, Ryan thought, and like Golovko, Ed Foley was an experienced pro for whom paranoia was always a way of life and often a tangible reality.
But we have something immediate to consider here. These are three good officers, Mary Pat said, taking the ball from her husband. Nomuri's been doing a fine job sliding himself into their society, taking his time, developing a good network of contacts. Clark and Chavez are as good a team of operators as we have. They have good cover identities, and they ought to be pretty safe.
Except for one thing, Jack added.
What's that? Ed Foley asked, cutting his wife off.
The PSID knows they're working.
Golovko? Mary Pat asked. Jack nodded soberly.
That son of a bitch, she went on. You know, they still are the best in the world.
Which was not an altogether pleasant admission from the Deputy Director Operations of the Central Intelligence Agency.
Don't tell me that they have the head of Japanese counter-intel under their control, her husband inquired delicately.
Why not, honey? They do it to everybody else,
which was true.
You know, sometimes I think we ought to hire some of their people just to give lessons. She paused for a second.
We don't have a choice.
Sergei didn't actually come out and say that, but I don't know how else he could have known.
No, Jack agreed with the DDO. We don't really have any choice at all.
Even Ed saw that now, which was not the same as liking it.
What's the quid on this one?
They want everything we get out of Thistle. They're a little concerned about this situation. They were caught by surprise, too, Sergei tells me.
But they have another network operating there. He told you that, too, MP observed.
And it has to be a good one, too.
Giving them the take from Thistle in return for not being hassled is one thing.
And a pretty big thing. This goes too far. Did you think this one all the way through, Jack? It means that they'll actually be running our people for us. Ed didn't like that one at all, but on a moment's additional consideration, it was plain that he didn't see an alternative either. Interesting circumstances, but Sergei says he was caught with his drawers down. Go figure. Ryan shrugged, wondering yet again how it was possible for three of the best-informed intelligence professionals in his country not to be able to understand what was going on. A lie on his part? Ed wondered. On the face of it, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Neither does lying, Mary Pat said. Oh, I love these Matryoshka puzzles. Okay, at least we know there are things we don't know yet. That means we have a lot of things to find out, the quicker the better. If we let RVS run our people, it's risky, Jack, but damn, I don't see that we have a choice.
I tell him yes, Jack asked.
He had to get the president's approval, too, but that would be easier than getting theirs. The Foleys traded a look and nodded. An ocean-going commercial tug was located by a helicopter 50 miles from the Enterprise formation, and in a remarkable set of circumstances, the frigate Gary took custody of the barge and dispatched the tug to the carrier where she could relieve the Aegis cruiser, and by the way, increase Big E's speed of advance to 9 knots. The tug's skipper contemplated the magnitude of the fee he'd garner under the Lloyd's open-form salvage contract, which the carrier's CO had signed and ferried back by helicopter. The typical court award was 10 to 15% of the value of the property salved. A carrier, an air wing, and 6,000 people, the tugboat crew thought. What was 10% of $3 billion? Maybe they'd be generous and settle for 5. It was a mixture of the simple and the complex, as always. There were now P-3C Orion patrol aircraft operating out of Midway to support the retreating battle force. It had taken a full day to reactivate the facilities at the Mid-Ocean Atoll, possible only because there was a team of ornithologists there studying the Goonies. The Orions were in turn supported by C-130s of the Hawaiian Air National Guard. However it had happened, the admiral, who still flew his flag on the crippled aircraft carrier, could look at a radar picture with 4 anti-submarine aircraft arrayed around his fleet and start to feel a little safer. His outer ring of escorts were hammering the ocean with their active sonars, and after an initial period of near panic, finding nothing much to worry about. He'd make Pearl Harbor by Friday evening, and maybe with a little wind could get his aircraft off, further safeguarding them. The crew was smiling now, Admiral Sato could see, as he headed down the passageway. Only 2 days before, they'd been embarrassed and shamed by the mistake their ship had made, but not now. He'd gone by ship's helicopter to all 4 of the Congos personally to deliver the briefings. 2 days away from the Marianas, they now knew what they had accomplished, or at least part of it. The submarine incidents were still guarded information, and for the moment they knew that they had avenged a great wrong to their country, done so in a very clever way, allowing Japan to reclaim land that was historically hers, and without, they thought, taking lives in the process. The initial reaction had been shock. Going to war with America? The admiral had explained that no, it was not really a war unless the Americans chose to make an issue of it, which he thought unlikely, but also something he warned them for which they had to be prepared. The formation was spread out now, 3,000 meters between ships, racing west at maximum sustainable speed. That was using up fuel at a dangerous rate, but there would be a tanker at Guam to refuel them, and Sato wanted to be under his own ASW umbrella as soon as possible. Once at Guam, he could consider future operations. The first one had been successful. With luck, there would not have to be a second. But if there were, he had many things to consider. Contacts, the admiral asked, entering the combat information center. Everything in the air is squawking commercial, the air warfare officer replied. Military aircraft all carry transponders, Sato reminded him, and they all work the same way. Nothing is approaching us. The formation was on a course deliberately offset from normal commercial air corridors, and on looking at the billboard display, the admiral could see the traffic was in all those corridors.
True, a military surveillance aircraft could see them from some of the commercial tracks, but the Americans had satellites that were just as good. His intelligence estimates had so far proved accurate. The only threat that really concerned him was from submarines, and that one was manageable. Submarine-launched harpoon or tomahawk missiles were a danger with which he was prepared to deal. Each of the destroyers had her Spy 1D radar up and operating, scanning the surface. Every fire control director was manned. Any inbound cruise missile would be detected and engaged, first by his American-made and Japanese-improved SM-2MR missiles, and behind those weapons were CIWS Gatling gun point defense systems. They would stop most of the inbound vampires, the generic term for cruise missiles. A submarine could close and engage with torpedoes, and one of the larger warheads could kill any ship in his formation. But they would hear the torpedo coming in, and his ASW helicopters would do their very best to pounce on the attacking sub, deny her the chance to continue the engagement, and just maybe kill her. The Americans didn't have all that many submarines, and their commanders would be correspondingly cautious, especially if he managed to add a third kill to the two already accomplished. What would the Americans do? Well, what could they do now, he asked himself. It was a question he'd asked himself again and again, and he always had the same answer. They'd drawn down too much. They depended on their ability to deter, forgetting that deterrence hinged on the perceived ability to take action if deterrence failed. The same old equation of don't want to, but can. Unfortunately for them, the Americans had leaned too much on the former and neglected the latter, and by all the rules Sato knew, by the time they could again, their adversary would be able to stop them. The overall strategic plan he'd helped to execute was not new at all, just better executed than it had been the first time, he thought, standing close to the triple billboard display and watching the radar symbols of commercial aircraft march along their defined pathways, their very action proclaiming that the world was resuming its normal shape, without so much as a blip. The hard part always seemed to come after the decisions were made, Ryan knew. It wasn't making them that wore on the soul, so much as having to live with them. Had he done the right things? There was no measure except hindsight, and that always came too late. Worse, hindsight was always negative because you rarely looked back to consider things that had gone right. At a certain level, things stopped being clear-cut. You weighed options and you weighed the factors, but very often you knew that no matter which way you jumped, somebody would be hurt. In those cases, the idea was to hurt the least number of people or things. But even then, real people were hurt who would otherwise not be hurt at all, and you were choosing, really, whose lives would be injured or lost. Like a disinterested god figure from mythology. It was worse still if you knew some of the players, because they had faces your mind could see and voices it could hear. The ability to make such decisions was called moral courage by those who didn't have to do it, and stress by those who did. And yet he had to do it. He'd undertaken this job in the knowledge that such moments would come. He'd placed Clark and Chavez at risk before in the East African desert, and he vaguely remembered worrying about that, but the mission had come off, and after that it had seemed like trick-or-treat on Halloween, a wonderfully clever little game played by nation against nation. The fact that a real human being in the person of Mohammed Abdul Corp had lost his life as a result, well, it was easy to say now that he deserved his fate. Ryan had allowed himself to file that entire memory away in some locked drawer to be dredged out years later should he ever succumb to the urge to write memoirs. But now the memory was back, removed from the files by the necessity to put the lives of real men at risk again. Jack locked his confidential papers away before heading toward the Oval Office. Off to see the boss, he told a Secret Service agent in the north-south corridor. Swordsman heading to jumper, the agent said into his microphone, for to those who protected everyone in what to them was known as the house, they were as much symbols as men, designations, really, for what their functions were. But I'm not a symbol, Jack wanted to tell him. I'm a man with doubts. He passed four more agents on the way and saw how they looked at him, the trust and respect. how they expected him to know what to do, what to tell the boss, as though he were somehow greater than they, and only Ryan knew that he wasn't. He'd been foolish enough to accept a job with greater responsibilities than theirs, that's all, greater than he'd ever wanted.
"Not fun, is it?" Durling said when he entered the office.
"Not much." Jack took his seat.
The president read his advisor's face and mind at the same time and smiled.
"Let's see, I'm supposed to tell you to relax, and you're supposed to tell me the same thing, right?"
"Hard to make a correct decision if you're overstressed," Ryan agreed.
"Yeah, except for one thing. If you're not stressed, then it isn't much of a decision, and it's handled at a lower level. The hard ones come here. A lot of people have commented on that," the president said.
It was a remarkably generous observation, Jack realized, for it voluntarily took some of the burden off his shoulders by reminding him that he did, after all, merely advise the president. There was greatness in the man at the ancient oak desk. Jack wondered how difficult a burden it was to bear, and if its discovery had come as a surprise, or merely, perhaps, as just one more necessity with which one had to deal.
"Okay, what is it?"
"I need your permission for something." Ryan explained the Golovko offers, the first made in Moscow and the second only a few hours earlier, and their implications.
"Does this give us a larger picture?" Durling asked.
"Possibly, but we don't have enough to go with."
"And?"
"A decision of this type always goes up to your level," Ryan told him.
"Why do I have to,
sir?" "It reveals both the identity of intelligence officers and methods of operation. I suppose technically it doesn't have to be your decision, but it is something you should know about."
"You recommend approval?"
Durling didn't have to ask.
"Yes, sir." "We can trust the Russians?"
"I didn't say trust, Mr. President. What we have here is a confluence of needs and abilities with a little potential blackmail on the side."
"Run with it," the President said,
without much in the way of consideration. Perhaps it was a measure of his trust in Ryan, thus returning the burden of responsibility back to his visitor. Durling paused for a few seconds before posing his next question.
"What are they up to, Jack?"
"The Japanese? On the face of it, this makes no objective sense at all. What I keep coming back to is why kill the submarines? Why kill people? It just doesn't seem necessary to have crossed that threshold."
"Why do this to their most important trading partner?" Durling added, making the most obvious observation. "We haven't had a chance to think it through, have we?"
Ryan shook his head. "Things have certainly piled up on us. We don't even know the things we don't know yet." The president cocked his head to the side.
"What?"
Jack smiled a little. "That's something my wife likes to say about medicine. You have to know the things you don't know. You have to figure out what the questions are before you can start looking for answers."
"How do we do that?"
"Mary Pat has people out asking questions. We go over all the data we have. We try to infer things from what we know, look for connections. You can tell a lot from what the other guy is trying to do and how he's going about it. My biggest one now, why did they kill the two subs?" Ryan looked past the president out the window to the Washington Monument, that fixed, firm obelisk of white marble. "They did it in a way that they think will allow us a way out. We can claim it was a collision or something."
"Do they really expect that we'll just accept the deaths?"
"And they offered us the chance. Maybe they don't expect it, but it is a possibility." Ryan was quiet for perhaps 30 seconds. No, they couldn't misread us that badly."
"Keep thinking out loud," Durling commanded.
"We've cut our fleet too far back.
I don't need to hear that now," was the answer,
an edge on it. Ryan nodded and held up a hand. "Too late to worry why or how, I know that. But the important thing is, they know it too. Everybody knows what we have and don't have, and with the right kind of knowledge and training, you can infer what we can do. Then you structure your operations on a combination of what you can do and what he can do about it."
"Makes sense. Okay, go on."
"With the demise of the Russian threat, the submarine force is essentially out of business. That's because a submarine is only good for two things, really. Tactically, submarines are good for killing other subs, but strategically, submarines are limited. They cannot control the sea in the same way as surface ships do. They can't protect power, they can't ferry troops or goods from one place to another, and that's what sea control really means. Jack snapped his fingers. But they can deny the sea to others, and Japan is an island nation, so they're afraid of sea denial. Or, Jack added in his own mind, maybe they just did what they could do. They crippled the carriers because they could not easily do more. Or could they? Damn, it was still too complicated.
So, we could strangle them with submarines, Durling asked.
Maybe, we did it once before. We're down to just a few, though, and that makes their counter-sub task a lot easier. But their ultimate trump against such a move on our part is their nuclear capacity. They counter a strategic threat to them with a strategic threat to us, a dimension they didn't have in 1941. There's something missing, sir. Ryan shook his head, still looking at the monument through the thick bullet-resistant windows. There's something big we don't know.
The why?
The why may be it. First, I want to know the what. What do they want? What is their endgame objective?
Not why they're doing it.
Ryan turned his head back to meet the president's eyes. Sir, the decision to start a war is almost never rational. World War I kicked off by some fool killing some other fool. Events were skillfully manipulated by Leopold something or other. Poldi, they called him, the Austrian foreign minister. Skilled manipulator, but he didn't factor in the simple fact that his country lacked the power to achieve what he wanted. Germany and Austria-Hungary started the war. They both lost. World War II, Japan and Germany took on the whole world. Never occurred to them that the rest of the world might be stronger, particularly true of Japan, Ryan went on. They never really had a plan to defeat us. Hold on that for a moment. The Civil War started by the South. The South lost. The Franco-Prussian War started by France. France lost. Almost every war since the Industrial Revolution was initiated by the side which ultimately lost. QED, going to war, is not a rational act. Therefore, the thinking behind it, the why, isn't necessarily important because it is probably erroneous to begin with.
I never thought of that, Jack.
Ryan shrugged. Some things are too obvious, like Buzz Fiedler said earlier today.
But if the why is not important, then the what isn't either, is it?
Yes, it is, because if you can discern the objective, if you can figure out what they want, then you can deny it to them. That's how you start to defeat an enemy. And, you know, the other guy gets so interested in what he wants, so fixed on how important it is, that he starts forgetting that somebody else might try to keep him from getting it.
Like a criminal thinking about hitting a liquor store, Durling asked, both amused and impressed by Ryan's discourse.
War is the ultimate criminal act, an armed robbery writ large. And it's always about greed. It's always a nation that wants something another nation has. And you defeat that nation by recognizing what it wants and denying it to them. The seeds of their defeat are usually found in the seeds of their desire.
Japan, World War II,
they wanted a real empire. Essentially, they wanted exactly what the Brits had. They just started a century or two too late. They never planned to defeat us, merely to... He stopped suddenly, an idea forming. Merely to achieve their goals and force us to acquiesce. Jesus, Ryan breathed. That's it. It's the same thing all over again, the same methodology, the same objective, he wondered aloud. It's there, the National Security Advisor told himself. It's all right there. If you can find it, if you can find it all.
But we have a first objective of our own, the president pointed out.
I know. George Winston supposed that, like an old fire horse, he had to respond to the bells. His wife and children still in Colorado. He was over Ohio now, sitting in the back of his Gulfstream, looking down at the crab shape of city lights, probably Cincinnati, though we hadn't asked the drivers about their route into Newark. His motivation was partially personal. His own fortune had suffered badly in the events of the previous Friday, drawn down by hundreds of millions.
The nature of the event and the way his money was spread around various institutions had guaranteed a huge loss, since he'd been vulnerable to every variety of programmed trading system. But it wasn't about money. Okay, he told himself, so I lost 200 mil. I have lots more where that came from. It was the damage to the entire system, and above all, the damage done to the Columbus Group. His baby had taken a huge hit, and like a father returning to the side of his married daughter in time of crisis, he knew that it would always be his. I should have been there, Winston told himself. I could have seen it and stopped it. At least I could have protected my investors. The full effects weren't in yet, but it was so bad as to be almost beyond comprehension. Winston had to do something, had to offer his expertise and counsel. Those investors were still his people. It was an easy ride into Newark. The Gulfstream touched down smoothly and taxied off to the General Aviation Terminal, where a car was waiting and one of his senior former employees. He wasn't wearing a tie, which was unusual for the Wharton School graduate. Mark Gant hadn't slept in 50 hours, and he leaned against the car for stability because the very earth seemed to move under him, to the accompaniment of a headache best measured on the Richter scale. For all that, he was glad to be here. If anyone could figure this mess out, it was his former boss. As soon as the private jet stopped, he walked over to stand at the foot of the stairs. How bad, was the first thing George Winston said. There was warmth between the two men, but business came first. We don't know yet, Gant replied, leading him to the car. Don't know. The explanation had to wait until they got inside. Gant handed over the first section of the Times without comment. Is this for real? A speed reader, Winston scanned across the opening two columns, turning back to page 21 to finish a story framed by lingerie ads. Gant's next revelation was that the manager Raizo Yamata had left behind was gone. He flew back to Japan Friday night, he said, to urge Yamata-san to come to New York to help stabilize the situation. Or maybe he wanted to gut himself open in front of his boss. Who the fuck knows? So, who the hell's in charge, Mark? Nobody, Gant answered, just like everything else here. God damn it, Mark, somebody has to be giving the orders. We don't have any instructions, the executive replied. I've called the guy. He's not at the office. Hey, I left messages. Tried his house. Yamada's house. Everybody's friggin' house. Everybody's friggin' office. Zippo, George. Everybody's running for cover. Hell, for all I know, the dumb fuck took a header off the biggest building in town. Okay, I need an office and all the data you have, Winston said. What data? Gant demanded. We don't have shit. The whole system went down, remember? You have the records of our trades, don't you? Well, yeah, I have our tapes, a copy anyway. Gant corrected himself. The FBI took the originals. A brilliant technician, Gant's first love had always been mathematics. Give Mark Gant the right instructions and he could work the market like a skilled card sharp with a new deck of bicycles. But like most of the people on the street, he needed someone else to tell him what the job was. Well, every man had some limitations, and on the plus side of the ledger, Gant was smart, honest, and he knew what his limitations were. He knew when to ask for help. That last quality put him in the top 3 or 4%. So he must have gone to Yamata and his man for guidance. When all this was going down, what instructions did you have? Instructions? Gant rubbed his unshaven face and shook his head. Hell, we busted our ass to stay ahead of it. If DTC gets its shit together, we'll come out with most of our ass intact. I laid a mega put on GM and made a real killing on gold stocks, and that's not what I mean. He said to run with it. He got us out of the bank stocks in one big hurry, thank God. Damn if he didn't see that one coming first. We were pretty well placed before it all went down. If it hadn't been for all the panic calls, I mean, Jesus, George, it finally happened, you know? 1-800-RUN. Jesus, if people had just kept their heads. A sigh. But they didn't, and now with the DTC fuck-up. George, I don't know what's going to be opening up tomorrow, man. If this is true, if they can rebuild the house by tomorrow morning, hey, man. I don't know, I just don't, Gant said as they entered the Lincoln Tunnel. The whole story of Wall Street in one exhausted paragraph, Winston told himself, looking at the glossy tile that made up the interior of the tunnel. just like the tunnel, in fact. You could see forward and you could see behind, but you couldn't see crap to the sides. You couldn't see outside the limited perspective. And you had to.
Mark, I'm still a director of the firm.
Yes, so?
And so are you, Winston pointed out.
I know that, but the two of us can call a board meeting, start making calls, George Winston ordered. As soon as we're out of this damn hole in the ground.